Cuba after Fidel, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Havana, Cubans are lining up to bid farewell to Fidel Castro.
Hundreds and hundreds of people standing, waiting patiently to file into a location where they're going to pay homage to Fidel Castro.
But in Miami, many Cuban exiles are not sad to hear of his death.
Castro as a figure just hovered over our entire story. I mean, we wouldn't be in the United States if it weren't for fleeing his tyranny.
Plus, the truth is hard to find these days.
The majority of people, even people who are relatively well-educated, can't tell the difference between fake news and real news. So we have to go back to the general principles of media literacy. We can't trust something just because our favorite person sent it to us.
Those stories and more today on The World. On the surface, he was a man with a thick beard and always a cigar in his mouth, for years anyway. Off the surface, there was so much more to say about the late Fidel Castro. Little surprise, as we'll hear later, that as a young revolutionary living in Mexico City, Castro was a loud talker. We start the show, though, in Havana, where today thousands of Cubans lined up to mourn Castro. It's part of the Communist Nation's official 9-day tribute to its longtime comandante. Reporter Frank Contreras is in Havana covering this week's historic events.
At the Plaza de la Revolución, you see long lines, hundreds and hundreds of people standing, waiting patiently to pay homage to Fidel Castro. It's unclear whether or not his ashen remains are there, but certainly you can see people coming out to remember him.
I know radio is being restricted to just somber music. Is that correct?
Right. The capital city of Cuba is quiet today, unusually quiet, Marco. You see flags at half-mast. Today, by the way, for the first time, we're going to get airline flights coming in from Florida filled with U.S. tourists that were cleared during the Obama years here. And they'll be landing in a Cuba that's quite solemn right now, so maybe not exactly the Cuba they were expecting to see.
Is it true that no alcohol is being served during this 9-day mourning period?
Well, we did some investigative reporting last night on that count and actually did find some nice cold Cristal beer here in Havana, Cuba. It's one of Cuba's main brands. And so you could buy that in some parts of the financial district in the areas where journalists are based.
Yeah, good cause for a little investigative journalism.
You got to report, you know.
On a serious note, though, Frank, I'm just wondering if there's a generational divide in terms of the response to Castro's death.
I really feel that that's the case, Marco. I've been staying with a citizen here, a woman who's in her 50s. And, you know, when she talks about her eyes well up with tears. But when you see younger Cubans on the streets, there's a lot of respect, certainly. But you sort of see, you know, a lighthearted bounciness among young people in the city today. So I think there is that generation divide that you're talking about.
What about the question, where does Cuba go from here? Are people not willing to think about the future yet?
We do know that the Cuban Navy, that includes a number of submarines, they're on high alert today, Marco, in this water space between Cuba and Florida. And so we're told that the military here is actually on standby just in case what they believe the aggressor, that's what they call the United States, to the north, might try something.
So, Frank, on a personal note, I gather that on the flight from Mexico City to Havana, you traveled with Antonio Del Conde. Fidel Castro's plan for Cuba's revolution was hatched in Mexico City, and Del Conde was the one who managed to secure for Fidel the famous yacht, the Granma, to take he and Che and his fighters to the island. Tell us about meeting El Cuate and his thoughts at this moment.
He's 91 years old, about 8 months older than Fidel Castro. He's very sad, dressed in black, in a state of mourning. Most Cubans don't do that, but Mexican citizens do. Antonio Del Conde is actually from the United States originally. He is the one, as you say, who got the yacht, the Granma, for Fidel Castro, a number of firearms as well. And so, you know, he's expressing a tremendous amount of sadness as he returns to Cuba. He says it just doesn't feel the same anymore without Fidel Castro.
Journalist Frank Contreras in Havana. Thanks very much, Frank.
Thank you.
Very different story on the other side of the Florida Straits. In Miami's Little Havana neighborhood, many are celebrating, have been celebrating since news of Castro's death broke late Friday, early Saturday. Danny Rivero is a Cuban-American journalist for Fusion, based in Miami. Over the weekend, he wrote an essay titled, "Here's Why People Are Celebrating Fidel Castro's Death, Even Though It Seems Gross to Do So." So where were you, Danny, when you heard the news, and what was the first thing you wanted to do?
So I was actually getting ready to go to sleep. I was about to brush my teeth, and I actually got a text message from a friend. He said Castro is dead. I thought it was a joke. It turned out not to be a joke, and I just didn't know what to do. And then at some point, 5 minutes later, I got up and I said, hey, I need to go to Versailles. It's kind of the epicenter of...
That's a big Cuban cafe restaurant, right?
Yeah, it just went without saying that people were going to go there. That was the place to be. So I just hopped in my car at almost 1 a.m. It just took off.
That was early, early Saturday morning. What was it like when you got there?
When I got there, the streets were still open. Cars were passing through. And within 20, 30 minutes, I mean, the police just shut down the street and people were out in their Friday clothes. It was a Friday night, 1 a.m. You know, people were still partying and people were showing up in their club clothes. And, you know, people that were at home brought their pots and pans and congueros, people playing congas came out. And it was just an impromptu carnival-esque atmosphere out there.
So you grew up here in the U.S. with kind of criticism of Castro being a common theme at the dinner table. There's one part in your essay about memories of Castro from those dinners that I just want to read. Castro, you write, was a lingering shadow. It was a pain we lived with every day. And the impotence of waking up every morning knowing that the SOB is still alive, living the good life like the head pig in Animal Farm while the rest of the people suffer under him. That ended last night. So remind us what families like yours have endured that meant Castro's death was a moment to celebrate.
Yeah, I mean, it's an intergenerational trauma is how I likened it in the essay. And what that means is that, I mean, my grandparents, they had a little properties, they had businesses that they ran, little corner shops, all that was stripped from them. If they tried to speak out about it, as my grandfather did, he was repeatedly jailed. Friends were locked up for decades, some of them with missing fingers that have been chopped off and tortured. And I mean, this was just as a Cuban American, this is the life that you grew up knowing. I mean, every Cuban American I know has stories of that are identical to these or even worse in some parts. Castro as a figure just hovered over our entire story. I mean, we wouldn't be in the United States if it weren't for fleeing his tyranny. So, I mean, this is really something that defines my generations of my family's life.
I mean, in the days following Fidel Castro's death, we hear the narrative that he was a despot. To others, the narrative is he was a revolutionary leader, a great man for his country. How do you feel about how his legacy is kind of being shaped now?
There's something that I fear is happening in the discourse on the left across the world, where people are kind of congratulating him and praising him for his life as a revolutionary and just normalizing. I mean, normalizing is a word that we hear a lot in reference to Donald Trump, that we shouldn't normalize Donald Trump because of his bombast and et cetera. But I mean, we've really seen the normalization in the last couple of days of Fidel Castro and his legacy. And unquestionably, he did some positive things in the world. I mean, he played a central role in ending the apartheid regime in South Africa by sending Cuban troops to Angola. Unquestionably, he was on the right side of history on that one. So he is a complicated figure, but I think ultimately as a leader of a country, you should be judged on what you did to your country and how free your country is. Do people want to move to your country or do people want to move out? And since he came into power, it's only gone in one direction. People only want to leave Cuba. The population is stagnated and it's actually decreasing. So I think that's a criticism statistically on his rule and his legacy that he leaves behind.
Danny Rivero is a journalist with Fusion based in Miami. Thanks very much for your time today, Danny.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
President-elect Trump has been weighing in on Castro's death via Twitter. Fidel Castro is dead, ! He tweeted that over the weekend. And then this morning he followed up with, if Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban-American people, and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate the deal. We wondered what that means for U.S.-Cuba relations going forward, so we asked Eduardo Gamarra to weigh in. He's a professor of politics and international relations at Florida International University in Miami.
What President-elect Trump is referring to is the political side of the equation. Members of our community have long been saying that what President Obama accepted gave a lot of concessions. Look, this week we have the inauguration of commercial flights to Cuba. You know, we already have cruises going to Cuba and so on. And so the argument is that we've given Cuba a lot of concessions on the economic front with no concessions on the political front. But the Cubans have been fairly clear on this. They are interested in making their economy more competitive, but they have no interest in making their political system more competitive. They do not believe in liberal representative democracy with multiple parties. They don't believe in pluralism. They believe in a centralized political system. And that's non-negotiable from their perspective. From our perspective, we want to push pluralism and we want to push human rights. And I think that those are very commendable things, but we need to also understand that I don't think Cuba is going to budge there. And in the end, I think Cuba will continue to open up its economy gradually, but will not relent on the political side.
So if Donald Trump decides to reverse the process that the White House and the State Department and the Cuban government have been kind of hashing out for well over 2 years, what does that do to pluralism in Cuba?
I don't think that there will be pluralism in Cuba. In fact, I think some of the criticisms of what has been happening on the island since December 17th of 2015 is that dissent has been severely repressed. Things have not gotten better for dissenters in Cuba, and they're unlikely to get better. And under the Trump administration, things are likely to get worse for dissenters in Cuba. But at the same time, I think it's also important to note that they have opened up so much recently, and there is such great interest now in Cuba from South Americans, Asians, and Europeans to invest in the island, that the reversal of the deal would essentially penalize Americans who have invested there, and even members of the Cuban American community who have been investing there as well.
What can the Trump administration do to hurt Cuba if that is at all on their agenda?
Frankly, one of the things that has provided a safety valve for Cuba for the last six decades has been immigration. This year, we have already had 40,000 Cubans leave the island and settle in the United States, mainly here in South Florida. Those are 40,000 less people that Cuba has to provide welfare, healthcare, employment, and so on. It's also 40,000 people who might serve as internal dissent. And that safety valve is the one that, in fact, Senator Rubio and others have been basically trying to close. And it's very curious and almost paradoxical that members of the old Cuban elite who are here in Florida are the ones that are attempting to close down now that immigration valve. Their argument is that these people are coming here not as political refugees, but as economic refugees. They're not opponents of the regime. Closing that loophole, in other words, doing away with the Cuban Adjustment Act, might serve more to penalize Cuba than closing the economic opening.
Eduardo, we've got to remember that Donald Trump is a real estate developer and hotelier first and foremost. Are you at all surprised that his first reaction to the death of Fidel Castro was not to say, oh, the Malecón in Havana, the waterfront corniche, it's ripe for exploitation now?
I'm not surprised by anything that the president-elect has to say, and I'm not surprised when he reverses himself. So I would not be surprised to find 6 months, a year down the road when it is no longer politically expedient, because right now, you know, the reality is that he probably had a lot of help from conservative sectors of the Cuban community here in Miami to win Florida. And, you know, he named Mauricio Claver, a very prominent Cuban exile here, to his transition team. And so right now he has some political debts to pay. Down the road, I would not be surprised if Mr. Trump is negotiating to build a Trump Tower on the Malecón.
Eduardo Gamarra, professor of politics and international relations at Florida International University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are with the world. France is gearing up for presidential elections this spring. The conservatives chose their candidate over the weekend. He's François Fillon, a former prime minister of France. The country's far right is also jockeying for attention. Marine Le Pen, leader of France's National Front, plans to run. She and her anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim party are growing in popularity and working hard to break into mainstream politics. Le Pen hopes Donald Trump's victory here in the U.S. bodes well for her, too. Reporter Adeline Sia has been speaking with supporters of the National Front in Burgundy.
The village of Brinon-sur-Armançon holds an outdoor fair every November. On this day, the weather is cold and windy, but some National Front supporters are out distributing their new flyer. It reads, "In the name of the people, Marine 2017. Julien Belcastro is only 19 years old, but a very motivated National Front youth member.
Le Front National est l'un des seuls partis qui laisse place à la jeunesse.
The National Front is one of the only parties that opens up to youth, he says. For me, Belcastro says, the party's most important goal is to restore national sovereignty. By that, he means breaking loose from the European Union and stopping what the party calls indiscriminate mass immigration. At a busy café down the street, National Front supporters are sipping hot drinks. Julien Odoul, who's a regional representative, says National Front voters are inspired by England's Brexit and the Donald Trump victory.
For all these forgotten French people, those we don't hear and have been dismissed by political parties for 30 years, who see insecurity rise and migrants come in, they can now be heard. We saw this in America with the vote for Donald Trump. This must give hope to all those French people who want change.
And change, he says, would come if Marine Le Pen became France's new president in 2017. I chat with other National Front supporters. One young mother opposes the teaching of Arabic as a second language in elementary school. A local winemaker says he got angry seeing immigrants getting free health care when he had expensive medical bills to pay. Their resentment is palpable, but not everyone at the fair today is a National Front supporter. A retiree called Dominique, he wouldn't give his last name, says he wants nothing to do with that party. For me, Marine Le Pen represents selfishness, he says. I volunteer with a Catholic nonprofit, and for us, the most important thing is sharing and solidarity. And Marine Le Pen does not represent those values at all. Up the street, clothes vendor Samir Moula says he would rather not see Marine Le Pen elected either. You can clearly see that I'm not with the National Front, he says. When I asked why it should be obvious, he points to his face. Moula is French, of Algerian parents. I have a brown complexion, he says, and the National Front is not for brown people. When I ask Julien Odoul, the National Front representative, about charges that the party is racist and xenophobic, he brushes it off.
We do not differentiate between French people. All French people are equal in front of the law, whatever their political choices are, whatever their religion, skin color, or sexual orientation.
Despite this inclusive language, the National Front is a hardline populist party that sees the world divided between patriots and globalists. Its leader, Marine Le Pen, has worked to normalize the party's fringe image since she took over its presidency from her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, notorious for his strongly anti-Semitic remarks. But in spite of her efforts, Jean-Yves Camus, a political analyst and expert on extremism, says the party is not likely to gain real political power soon.
The Front National has become more mainstream, but the real problem is the conservative mainstream right sees the National Front as pretty much on the fringe. And as long as the conservative mainstream parties do not accept a coalition with the National Front, the National Front will not be able to implement their policies.
At least that's what many hope. But the Brexit victory and the Trump election may suggest otherwise. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Brinon-sur-Armançon, France.
It's a good thing for Germany that we had our election first. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is running for re-election next year, and she is now sounding the alarm about fake news. In a speech last week, Merkel said that fake news websites, along with so-called bots that spew computer-generated content, pose a real threat to German democracy. She warned that more needs to be done about fake news and its appeal to lots of people. Thomas Jartzombeck is a German lawmaker who works on digital security. He says most of Germany's political parties have agreed not to use bots on social media platforms like Twitter.
There is only one party, the new right AfD, that said we will use them, but the rest of the field says that's not a transparent way in communicating politics.
That's all well and good, says Alison Powell, an assistant professor of media and communications at the London School of Economics. But she says the problem with these bots is that they're typically unleashed by actors outside the political system, and that can mean entities outside of the country in question. In any case, the bots continue their brutally efficient work.
bots can be set to do all kinds of things. They can retweet, they can follow, they can have little pieces of software that kind of have a response to a particular claim. So if someone tweeted a pro-Clinton message, you could set up a bot that would insult the person having that Twitter account. But the thing with bots that's different than having people do this is that you can have a sort of sheer volume of messages coming from bots.
After all the talk about Russian hacking during the run-up to the U.S. presidential election, the Germans are worried about the same. Again, here's lawmaker Thomas Jartsombeck. He's a member of Chancellor Merkel's ruling center-right party.
Yes, we are pretty concerned about that because we have seen some attacks on the servers of our party. We have seen attacks on the servers of the German Bundestag. Nobody can prove who was behind it, but it seems to be pretty obvious.
Jartsombeck says there needs to be a serious discussion about how to combat the use of bot-generated content. But fake news, much of it written by actual humans, may be the bigger problem. Allison Powell says internet users also have a part to play.
There have been some recent kind of surface but interesting studies that show that the majority of people, even people who are relatively well-educated, can't tell the difference between fake news and real news. And I think this is, like with the bots, an opportunity for us to really think about how do we check the sources of the information that we get. So we have to go back to the general principles of media literacy. We can't trust something just because our favorite person sent it to us.
In other words, don't believe what you read just because your good friend or former classmate posted it on their Facebook wall or Twitter timeline. Do some fact-checking yourself, even if it's less satisfying than just hitting share immediately. Makes common sense, right? You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, an apartment with a secret.
It's down a little street. It's this really run-down building. There's a little plaque on the front of it that says, you know, this is where Che and Fidel met and, you know, talked revolution.
When Fidel met Che in Mexico City, plus a Mohawk language immersion class, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. An update now on what's happening in the Syrian city of Aleppo. For years, since the beginning of the civil war there, the Syrian government has laid siege to the rebels holding the eastern part of the city. Now the Syrian army has finally broken through and taken control of a big slice of Aleppo away from the rebels. This man, Ismail, is one of the emergency rescue workers in the city known as the White Helmets, and he sums up how a lot of people in Aleppo are feeling right now.
I'm scared, really scared of what is going to happen. Me and my friends here, we are trying to move because we know what will happen if they capture us. They will kill us.
My colleague Hanan Razek with the BBC's Arabic service is following events in Aleppo from her base in London. Hanan, with the Syrian army breaking through, I'm just curious what that rescue worker Ismail was referring to when he says, if they capture us, they will kill us. Who's he talking about?
I think he's talking about the government forces. If they are captured by the Syrian army forces, they are afraid what's going to happen to them then. You know, Marco, if we can picture a map of how Aleppo looks like right now, the western side of Aleppo has always been under the control of the government, and the east side, until a few days ago, has been under the control of the rebels. Now, the government forces and the army has actually managed to take around one-third of the ground that used to be under the control of the rebels.
So, as far as you can tell, Hanan, where does this leave civilians in those areas of Aleppo that are still being held by rebels? What's happening to them?
You know, until 2 days ago, we know from the UN that there is around more than 250,000 civilians besieged in the eastern side of Aleppo. But we're not sure, of course, Marco, of the exact number, but this is an estimate that we are being given by the UN. So we know that those people are under siege. We hear from eyewitnesses that the humanitarian situation is so dire. I saw a tweet from a seven-year-old girl called Bana Al-Abid, who has thousands of followers on Twitter, and she tweets pictures of her from inside Aleppo. And there was a picture of her last night, and she said that her house is gone, and she's now in rubbles. So you can see that how the humanitarian situation is actually deteriorating in the eastern side of Aleppo, and there is a big question there, what's going to happen to civilians inside now?
Hanan, just one more quick question. What is your sense of Aleppo right now? Is it kind of like Damascus, where there's fighting, but some areas of the city, there's absolutely no fighting, it's almost kind of normal?
Of course, it's very hard to get a real sense, because, you know, the information we're getting from there is, it's not easy to get in the first place. But the sense you have is like you have one side where there is a dire humanitarian situation and hospitals lacking aid that they can give to people, rebels who are actually losing ground right now. But then on the other side is the more controlled area of the government. Of course, there is violence on both sides, but at the same time, it's different. You have civilians here, or they suffer aerial bombardments and cluster bombs. On the other side, you have hospitals that are still working in a way. Basically, Marco, it's very difficult to actually get a real picture of what's happening there. But this is what we get from, you know, Twitter and the White Helmets guys, etc.
My colleague at the BBC's Arabic service, Hanan Razek, speaking with me from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
We often turn to Joshua Landis for analysis of events in Syria. Landis is director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. So the rebels are fighting as hard as they can, but they don't seem able to stop Assad's troops. What's giving the Assad regime its edge right now after years of what was a stalemate?
It's the Russians. The Russians, a year ago, entered into this battle, and they've turned everything around for the Syrian army. Also, Hezbollah, Iranian advisors, and some Iraqi militias are playing a big role in this. So there's a lot of outside help. But the rebels have been getting weaker. They're getting less aid from outside. I think the region is weary. Saudi Arabia is completely immersed in Yemen. And Turkey has gone through a coup. So the people who've normally supported the rebels are not there.
What kind of impact has the U.S. election had on morale amongst the rebels? I mean, my sense is that Hillary Clinton was the last best hope for the Syrian opposition.
Well, rebel morale is in the dumps. And Trump is bad for rebels. That was the conclusion they came to early. Trump had said, you know, we don't know who the rebels are. They're possibly worse than Assad. He had talked about working with the Russians. All of that was bad news for the rebels. But they had tried. In the last 6 months, the rebels put everything they had into breaking the siege in Aleppo. So they had spent their force in trying to break the siege in vain. And now the Syrians in the last month have been massing troops, and they've gone after this with everything they have.
Yeah. So little by little, they encroach into Aleppo. What about morale for the Syrian army? I mean, are they thinking that Donald Trump presents this new narrative come January 20th that will be beneficial to them?
They do. They do think it's beneficial, and they're doing everything they can to create facts on the ground right now so that when Donald Trump comes in, their success is really a fait accompli, so that he will not think that he should be supporting the rebels. And by taking Aleppo, Aleppo is where most of the moderate militias that the United States has traditionally been helping with arms and training and so forth had their center. So once that's gone, the rebel center moves to Idlib. That is a dusty province where al-Qaeda and other Salafist groups like Ahrar al-Sham predominate. And it'll be very hard for Trump or anybody who wants to help rebels to send military arms to those rebels, because they're too Islamist for the United States and for most of Europeans.
You really think all of Aleppo could fall?
Yes, I believe that the Aleppo in the next month or two, the Syrian regime says by New Year's, perhaps that's optimistic, but it's surrounded. They can't get reinforcements. They can't get new arms. It's only a matter of time.
So what does this mean? Is this the beginning of the end of the rebellion against Bashar al-Assad, the thing that started the civil war in the first place back in 2011?
It is. It is. I think it is. There's, of course, still a lot of Syria that's not in government control. There's ISIS Syria, but the United States is determined to destroy ISIS. Turkey has moved in from the north in the last several months and taken a little hunk of the north. And the Kurds, of course, have carved out a statelet, if you will, that they're looking for a wide degree of autonomy in. So the Syrian government is very far from retaking all of Syria today.
But you do believe that this is an important moment in the civil war, it sounds like.
It is, because the American-backed militias are being destroyed one after the next by the Syrian regime. And that means that the American role, other than fighting ISIS, will largely be over. By the time Trump comes in, it'll be very difficult for him to think about replacing Assad with rebel troops.
Aside from establishing facts on the ground before Donald Trump becomes president, is there something innate in Donald Trump that gives Bashar al-Assad some hope?
Yes, and he said so himself. He said this is good news. He not in those words, but he said he hopes to work with Trump. When he heard that Trump wanted to work with the Russians, that means working with Assad. And we have to remember that Trump was a big critic of Hillary Clinton in Libya, where he said regime change was stupid and what Hillary did in Libya was bad. And he made the same criticism for Iraq. He called Iraq the Harvard of jihadism. And he blamed George Bush, the son, for doing that. So he has been very critical of regime change and of getting rid of dictators. And that suggests to Bashar al-Assad that he has a friend in the White House, or at least someone who's not going to try to drive him from power.
Josh Landis, Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
The Mohawk Nation straddles the U.S.-Canada border where New York State meets Ontario. It's a border that many members of the tribe don't officially recognize. And for more than a century, governments on both sides of that border forcibly sent Mohawk children to English-only boarding schools. This process brought the Mohawk language to the brink of extinction. But more than 35 years ago, members of the Mohawk tribe in New York State decided to fight back by creating a school of their own. Reporter Alina Simone recently paid it a visit.
It's a Friday morning ritual at the Akwesasne Freedom School. Some 65 teachers and kids, sporting a mixture of headdresses and hoodies, form a circle and make their way around the room to the beat of a water drum, chanting in native Mohawk. They always begin with this song, Standing Quiver, a tribute to hunters. It's a social song, not a ceremonial one, which is why I'm allowed to tape it. A lot of reservation schools maintain traditions like these, but when the drum stops beating, the kids go back to class and back to speaking English. But here at Akwesasne, English is the foreign language.
You hear that in the words, and then the A-H is a oh sound.
This is Kahetante, one of Akwesasne's phonics teachers.
And we've been working on these sound charts since August to get it perfect before we can go into the actual incorporating and conjugating of the words.
They also have to find creative ways to adapt ancient words to a very modern world.
How do you say monopoly in Mohawk?
Money. There's a lot of money involved, so we just called it the swista, you know, because owista is money. But they have to use all the words in Mohawk.
Like many other teachers at the school, Kahetante is a native speaker of Mohawk, which is unusual among tribes of the East Coast. But the remoteness of the St. Regis Reservation, which sprawls from New York State across a necklace of islands and into Canada, has made the Mohawk more resistant to assimilation, like when agents from native boarding schools on both sides of the border came for their children.
The government schools are constantly being built. We bring them in, clean them up, and start them on their way to civilization.
So it was common just for people not within the family, but the Indian agent or an official of the government to come into the home and say, we're taking your children because it's obvious to us you can't take care of them.
This is Kaya Tahente, an upper-level teacher at the Freedom School.
My father didn't go because his father told the authorities that they could take care of him.
Today, they all speak English, and some have taken business courses, home economics, and other higher training.
The Freedom School inverts the practices of those institutions, boarding schools where traditional clothing, rituals, and native languages were banned, by putting Mohawk first.
We're not just teaching you to be a Mohawk who thinks like the outside system, but thinks in Mohawk. We're teaching our students to be Mohawks and to speak from the Mohawk perspective, or Haudenosaunee perspective, which is controversial.
Yagotni Gona Osta, known by her nickname Peachy, was an early teacher at the Freedom School, which she also helped found in the late 70s, a decade when enrollment in Native American boarding schools was at its peak. During this time, from 1979 to 1980, the reservation was in tumult, locked in an armed standoff against the U.S. government and divided against itself over what began as a dispute over building a fence around the U.S. side of the reservation. Parents began to question busing their kids past roadblocks to state schools off the reservation.
I think there was like 25 of us that used to sit in a group and figure out how are we going to start a school.
Meanwhile, members on the Canadian side had recently created a new school called the Ganawage Survival School as a means of literally ensuring the Mohawk language and culture survived. Suddenly, Peachy and her group had a new model.
There were women that were here that were helping us protest that were from Ganawage, and they were like, we can do this. Don't be afraid to do this. And so people took their kids out of school and we started the school.
Mohawk language was just part of the curriculum at first. The decision to go full immersion only came 5 years later, and it was a bittersweet moment for Peachy.
Well, I was one of the teachers, and I don't speak Mohawk. I have a very small vocabulary in Mohawk. There were several of us that didn't speak Mohawk because we were brought up in the public school system, which doesn't teach Mohawk. So in the beginning, that's what we had. It went on with a lot of English, and there was Mohawk language being taught all the time, but it wasn't all day. It was a heartbreak, actually, for us to make that decision to go total immersion because I knew that I wouldn't have a place here to teach anymore.
Ultimately, as a parent, most of Peachy's 10 children are graduates of the Freedom School. She agreed with the decision to make it a Mohawk-only speaking school, even though it did mean giving up her job.
The Ogwazusne Freedom School, the word freedom in there, has to do with the freedom to think. And to be able to think, you need to be able to understand the language. And so that's why, for us English speakers, for our children, we think that we should push that the language be number one.
For the world, this is Alina Simone from the St. Regis Mohawk Reservation.
For more stories about languages and the people who speak them, check out our World in Words podcast. You'll find it at iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Korean flavors are hot these days. American chefs are making tacos, hamburgers, even Bloody Marys with Korean touches. But the ingredients behind those flavors can't always be transported easily across continents. So one woman in California is growing her own Korean vegetables and learning more about Korea and herself along the way. Alyssa Jung Perry has our story.
Kristen Leach's farm is on a one-acre plot in rural Alameda County. She's tanned and weathered from spending day after day out here, often alone.
I'm just generally kind of a private person, and so I guess I just do feel a little more comfort around plants than people, which is probably part of why I have this job.
Kristen doesn't cultivate corn, tomatoes, and kale. Instead, there are rows of organic Korean chili peppers, melons, and cabbage for kimchi.
We have two rows of this type of just open-pollinated Napa cabbage called Aichi, and then we have two.
It started when she moved to the Pacific Northwest for college, and she saw a sesame-like herb called perilla growing in a community garden.
Pretty much a lot of older Korean ladies in this garden, and everyone just grew perilla. Unbeknownst to me at the time, it's just sort of one of the more ubiquitous plants and ingredients in Korean food. So it's just very beloved.
She didn't know about perilla because even though she was born in Korea, she didn't grow up eating Korean food.
I was adopted in 1982, and I was born in July, and I was adopted in November, I think. So.
Kristen grew up in a blue-collar family on Long Island in New York, eating things like mac and cheese, hot dogs, and spaghetti.
I remember just my grandma would make us spaghetti with meat sauce, and it just seemed like really special.
Food has always played an important part in her life in terms of identity. She doesn't talk much about herself and about being adopted, but when she does, it's careful and considered, and it's often through the lens of farming.
I think that coming at it from like the place of like connecting to plants was just the safest place, sort of point of entry for me, just because it could be personal. I didn't have to like go out and interact with other people. So it was something that I could just sort of do on my own and research and then grow something, but I didn't have to like explain it to anybody or talk about it even. I just got to grow it and relate to the plant. So these are the Korean chamoy melon.
She started with a small home garden using a catalog from an Asian seed company in Oakland.
And so I just like ordered everything that said it was Korean, basically. So it made it fairly easy. I just feel like finding that catalog was finding like a little treasure map or something.
She eventually rented a plot of land and named it Namu, after a Korean restaurant she now partners with. Namu means tree in Korean. The farm has helped her tap into something that she really couldn't get at before.
It has connected me with so many people that share with me their own experiences, that trust me with the things that impact them as a Korean or Korean American.
And it's led her to travel back to Korea for the first time since she was adopted. In 2014, she went to meet with some Korean farmers there. Now they're collaborating on a project to preserve native Korean seeds back in California. Her tiny farm has connected her to a whole new community.
Many people just like email out of nowhere. You know, strangers would contact me and say that they were Korean or that they were Korean American. People I didn't know would like offer to share seeds with me. You know, like people felt like they had a place that they could like put something of their own story.
For The World, Alyssa Jung Perry, Sunol, California.
Let's come back to the death of Fidel Castro. We reported earlier on the show on reactions to his death from Cubans on the island and here in the U.S., and what the Donald Trump presidency might do regarding Cuba once he's in the White House. But right now, let's go back to the summer of 1955, when Fidel Castro was living in exile in Mexico and planning the next steps in his revolution. The World's Monica Campbell joins me now from Mexico City. So, Monica, I know Fidel had already once tried launching his socialist revolution against Fulgencio Batista in Cuba and failed. So in 1955, he's in Mexico City doing what?
Well, he's plotting the revolution, and he was apparently quite poor, kind of living off of tortas, you know, sandwiches here, scraping by, trying to raise funds, and then meeting with other Cubans, sympathetic Cubans. And that's when he met Che Guevara, who was in Mexico City and struggling as well. And he was working at a medical clinic here. So they were introduced. Then the group started getting bigger. They started amassing some funds, collecting money for weapons. You know, they spent some time here in Mexico City.
Right. And so there's an apartment where Fidel Castro was living in Mexico City. Is it pretty well known?
You'd have to be a bit of a Cuban history geek to know about it. I mean, I was surprised because it's this pretty rundown apartment building in Mexico City. There's a little plaque that says, you know, this is where Che and Fidel met and, you know, talked revolution. I mean, it's kind of eerie. You go into the building, it's down this long, kind of dilapidated hallway. You just look at it, you just think you could write a whole novel just looking at this door, you know, imagining what the scene was like, you know, at the time. I actually ended up going inside because I approached a couple of the women who live there. And this is what one of the women told me. She lives in that building, and then her relatives, her mother-in-law, remembered hearing these Cuban revolutionaries in this apartment building, and she said they were loud talkers.
Salieron los militares con el armamento.
She was saying that the military police came for Fidel and the other revolutionaries, and that they escaped through the apartment window, and that the military police, the Mexican police, they had found weapons and documents, and then they tried to find Fidel, but apparently he was hiding in a grocery store nearby owned by some sympathetic Spaniards. So goes the history. And eventually, Fidel and Che, they were arrested. They were jailed in Mexico for some time. And then when they were released, they headed to the state of Veracruz, where they had arranged to have this yacht called the Granma, the famous yacht, which they took back to Cuba. And today, when you go to Havana, at the Revolutionary Museum there in Havana, that yacht is now a big part of the draw.
Have any Cuban expats themselves showed up at the apartment since Castro died?
I didn't see any. I mean, I wasn't there for that long. But, you know, I talked to one man I know. I see him a lot. He runs an ice cream stall not far from my house, actually. You know, he got quite emotional because he left Cuba many years ago. He teared up actually talking to me because he said his dad was a diehard communist. For him, Fidel's death kind of brought up this unresolved divide, you know, with his father. A lot of his customers came up while I was sitting there talking to him. And, you know, they said, you know, por fin, you know, like at last Fidel's died, and as if he were going to, you know, he was jubilant about it, but he wasn't. It was very bittersweet for him.
The World's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
And speaking of por fin, that's all from us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.